I had an inch on him, but he had 20 pounds on me.
Do you really want to die without knowing what it's like?
How do you know I don't? I said, yanking free. Don't ever touch me again. Changing the subject.
Nobody's gonna know, he said. I won't tell anyone.
He tried to grab me again. I slapped his hand away with my left and popped him hard in the nose with the open palm of my right. It opened up a faucet of bright red blood. It ran into his mouth and he gagged.
Bitch, he gasped. At least you've got someone. At least everybody you ever frigging knew in your life isn't dead.
He busted out in tears, fell onto the path and gave into it, the bigness of it, the big Buick that's parked over you, the horrible feeling that, as bad as it's been, it's going to get worse. Ah, crap. I sat on the path next to him, told him to lean his head back. He complained that made the blood run down his throat.
Don't tell anybody, he begged. I'll lose my cred.
I laughed. I couldn't help it.
Where'd you learn to do that? He asked.
Girl Scouts.
There's badges for that?
There's badges for everything. Actually, it was 7 years of karate classes. I dropped karate last year. Don't remember my reasons now. They seemed like good ones at the time.
I'm one too, he said.
What? He spat a wad of blood and mucus into the dirt.
A virgin?
What a shock. What makes you think I'm a virgin? I asked.
You wouldn't have hit me if you weren't.
Chapter 14. On our sixth day in camp, I saw a drone for the first time, glittering gray in the bright afternoon sky. There was a lot of shouting and running around, people grabbing guns, waving their hats and shirts, or just spazzing in general, crying, jumping, hugging, high-fiving one another. They thought they were rescued. Hutchfield and Brogdon tried to calm everybody down, but weren't very successful. The drone zipped across the sky, disappeared behind the trees, then came back, slower this time. From the ground, it looked like a blimp. Hutchfield and Dad huddled in the doorway of the barracks, watching it, swapping a pair of binoculars back and forth.
No wings, no markings, and did you see that first pass? Mach 2, at least. Unless we've launched some kind of classified aircraft, no way this thing is terrestrial.
As he spoke, Hutchfield was popping his fist up and down in the dirt, beating out a rhythm to match the words. Dad agreed. We were herded into the barracks. Dad and Hutchfield hovered in the doorway, still swapping the binoculars back and forth.
Is it the aliens? Sammy asked. Are they coming, Cassie?
Shh.
I looked over and saw Crisco watching me.
20 minutes, he mouthed.
If they come, I'm going to beat them up, Sammy whispered. I'm going to karate kick them and I'm going to kill them all.
That's right, I said, nervously running my hand over his hair.
I'm not going to run, he said. I'm going to kill them for killing Mommy.
The drone vanished. Straight up, Dad told me later. If you blinked, you missed it. We reacted to the drone the way anyone would react. We freaked. Some people ran, grabbed whatever they could carry and raced into the woods. Some just took off with the clothes on their backs and the fear in their guts. Nothing Hutchfield said could stop them. The rest of us huddled in the barracks until night came on. Then we took the freak-out party to the next level. Had they spotted us? Were the stormtroopers or clone army or robot walkers next? Were we about to be fried by laser cannons? It was pitch black. We couldn't see a foot in front of our noses because we didn't dare light the kerosene lamps. Frantic whispers, muffled crying, huddled on our cots, jumping at every little sound. Hutchfield assigned the best marksman to the night watch. If it moved, shoot it. No one was allowed outside without permission, and Hutchfield never gave permission. That night lasted 1,000 years. Dad came up to me in the dark and pressed something into my hands.
a loaded semi-automatic Luger.
You don't believe in guns, I whispered.
I used to not believe in a lot of things. A lady started to recite the Lord's Prayer. We called her Mother Teresa. Big legs, skinny arms, a faded blue dress, wispy gray hair. Somewhere along the way, she had lost her dentures. She was always working her beads and talking to Jesus. A few others joined her. Then some more. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. At which point her arch-nemesis, the sole atheist in Camp Ashpit's foxhole, a college professor named Dawkins, shouted out, "Particularly those of extraterrestrial origin." "You're going to hell!" a voice yelled at him in the dark. "How will I know the difference?" Dawkins hollered back.
"Quiet," Hutchfield called softly from his spot in the doorway. "Stow that praying, people."
"His judgment has come upon us," Mother Teresa wailed.
Sammy scooted closer to me on the cot. I shoved the gun between my legs. I was afraid he might grab it and accidentally blow my head off.
"Shut up, all of you," I said. "You're scaring my brother."
"I'm not scared," Sammy said, his little fist twisting in my shirt. "Are you scared, Cassie?"
"Yes," I said. I kissed the top of his head. His hair smelled a little sour. I decided to wash it in the morning. If we were still there in the morning.
"No, you're not," he said. "You're never scared."
"I'm so scared right now I could pee my pants."
He giggled. His face felt warm in the crook of my arm. Did he have a fever? That's how it starts. I told myself I was being paranoid. He'd been exposed 100 times. And the red tsunami roars in fast once you're exposed, unless you have immunity. And Sammy had to have it. If he didn't, he'd already be dead.
"You better put on a diaper," he teased me. "Maybe I will. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death."
She wasn't going to stop. I could hear her beads clicking in the dark. Dawkins was humming loudly to drown her out. 3 blind mice. I couldn't decide who was more annoying, the fanatic or the cynic.
"Mommy said they might be angels," Sammy said suddenly.
"Who?" I asked.
"The aliens. When they first came, I asked if they came to kill us, and she said maybe they weren't aliens at all. Maybe they were angels from heaven, like in the Bible, when the angels talked to Abraham and to Mary and to Jesus and everybody."
"They sure talked a lot more to us back then," I said.
"But then they did kill us. They killed Mommy."
He started to cry.
"Thou prepared a table for me in the presence of my enemies."
I kissed the top of his head and rubbed his arms.
"Thou anointed my head with oil." "Cassie, does God hate us?"
"No, I don't know.
Does he hate Mommy?"
"Of course not. Mommy was a good person."
"Then why did he let her die?"
I shook my head. I felt heavy all over, like I weighed 20,000 tons.
"My cup runneth over." "Why did he let the aliens come and kill us? Why doesn't God stop them?"
"Maybe," I whispered slowly. Even my tongue felt heavy. "Maybe he will."
"Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life." "Don't let them get me, Cassie. Don't let me die."
"You're not going to die, Sams."
"Promise?"
I promised.
Chapter 15. The next day, the drone came back. Or a different drone, identical to the first. The others probably hadn't traveled all the way from another planet with just one in the hold. It moved slowly across the sky. Silent. No growl of an engine. No hum. Just gliding soundlessly like a fishing lure drawn through still water. We hustled into the barracks. No one had to tell us. I found myself sitting on a cot next to Crisco.
"I know what they're going to do," he whispered.
"Don't talk," I whispered back.
He nodded and said,
"Sonic bombs. You know what happens when you're blasted with 200 decibels? Your eardrums shatter, your lungs bust open and air gets into your bloodstream, and then your heart collapses.
Where do you come up with this crap, Crisco?"
Dad and Hutchfield were crouched by the open door again. They watched the same spot for several minutes. Apparently, the drone had frozen in the sky.
"Here, I got you something,"
Crisco said. It was a diamond pendant necklace. Body booty from the ash pit. "That's disgusting," I told him.
"Why? It's not like I stole it or anything,"
he pouted.
"I know what it is. I'm not stupid. It's not the necklace, it's me. You'd take it in a heartbeat if you thought I was hot."
I wondered if he was right. If Ben Parrish had dug the necklace out of the pit, would I have taken the gift?
"Not that I think you are," Crisco added.
Bummer. Crisco the grave robber didn't think I was hot.
"Then why do you want to give it to me?"
"I was a douche that night in the woods. I don't want you to hate me, think I'm a creeper."
A little late for that.
"I don't want dead people's jewelry," I said.
"Neither do they," he said, meaning dead people.
He wasn't going to leave me alone. I scooted up to sit behind Dad. Over his shoulder, I saw a tiny gray dot, a silvery freckle on the unblemished skin of the sky.
"What's happening?" I whispered. Right when I said that, the dot disappeared. Moved so fast it seemed to wink out.
"Reconnaissance flights," Hutchfield breathed. "Has to be."
"We had satellites that could read someone's watch from orbit," Dad said quietly.
"If we could do that with our primitive technology, why would they need to leave their ship to spy on us?" "You got a better theory?"
Hutchfield didn't like his decisions being questioned.
"They may have nothing to do with us," Dad pointed out. "These things might be atmospheric probes, or devices used to measure something they can't calibrate from space. Or they're looking for something that can't be detected until we're mostly neutralized."
Then Dad sighed. I knew that sigh. It meant he believed something was true that he didn't want to be true.
"It comes down to a simple question, Hutchfield. Why are they here? Not to rape the planet for our resources. There's plenty of those spread evenly throughout the universe, so you don't have to travel hundreds of light years to get them. Not to kill us, though killing us or most of us is necessary. They're like a landlord who kicks out a deadbeat renter so he can get the house cleaned up for the new tenant. I think this has always been about getting the place ready."
"Ready? Ready for what?" Dad smiled humorlessly.
"Moving day."
Chapter 16. An hour before dawn. Our last day at Camp Ashpit. A Sunday. Sammy beside me. Little kid snugly warm, hand on his bear, the other hand on my chest, curled up pudgy baby fist. The best part of the day. Those few seconds when you're awake but empty. You forget where you are. What you are now, what you were before. It's all breath and heartbeat and blood moving. Like being in your mother's womb again. The peace of the void. That's what I thought the sound was at first. My own heartbeat. Thumpa, thumpa, thumpa. Faint, then louder, then really loud. Loud enough to feel the beat on your skin. A glow sprang up in the room, grew brighter. People were stumbling around, yanking on clothes, fumbling for guns. The bright glow faded, came back. Shadows jumped across the floor, raced up the ceiling. Hutchfield was yelling at everyone to stay calm. It wasn't working. Everyone recognized the sound, and everyone knew what that sound meant. Rescue! Hutchfield tried to block off the doorway with his body. "Stay inside," he hollered. "We don't want to..." He was shoved out of the way. "Oh yes, we do." We poured out the doorway and stood in the yard and waved at the helicopter, a Black Hawk, as it made another sweep of the compound, black against the lightening dark of the pre-dawn sky. The spotlight stabbed down, blinding us, but most of us were already blinded by tears. We jumped, we shouted, we hugged one another. A couple of people were waving little American flags, and I remember wondering where the hell they got those. Hutchfield was furiously screaming at us to get back inside. Nobody listened. He wasn't the boss of us anymore. The people in charge had arrived. And then, just as unexpectedly as it had come, the helicopter made one last turn and thundered out of sight. The sound of its rotors faded. A heavy silence flooded in after it. We were confused, stunned, frightened. They must have seen us. Why didn't they land? We waited for the helicopter to come back. All morning we waited. People packed up their things, speculated about where they would take us, what it would be like, how many others would be there. A Black Hawk helicopter! What else had survived the first wave? We dreamed of electric lights and hot showers. No one doubted we'd be rescued now that the people in charge knew about us. Help was on its way. Dad, being Dad, of course, wasn't so sure. "They may not come back," he said. "They wouldn't just leave us here, Dad," I said. Sometimes you had to talk to him like he was Sammy's age. How does that make sense? "It may not have been a search and rescue. They might have been looking for something else." "The drone?" "The one that had crashed a week earlier," he nodded. "Still, they know we're here now," I said. "They'll do something." He nodded again, absently, like he was thinking about something else. "They will," he said. He looked hard at me. "Do you still have the gun?" I patted my back pocket. He threw his arm around me and led me to the storehouse. He pulled aside an old tarp lying in a corner. Underneath it was an M16 semi-automatic assault rifle, the same rifle that would become my bestie after everyone else was gone. He picked it up and turned it in his hands, inspecting the rifle with that same absent-minded professor look in his eyes. "What do you think?" he whispered. "About that? It's totally badass." He didn't jump on me for the language. Instead, he gave a little laugh. He showed me how it worked, how to hold it, how to aim, how to switch out a clip. "Here, you try." He held it toward me. I think he was pleasantly surprised by what a quick study I was, and my coordination was pretty good thanks to the karate lessons. Dance classes have nothing on karate when it comes to developing grace. "Keep it," he said when I tried to hand it back. "I hid it in here for you." "Why?" I asked. Not that I minded having it, but he was freaking me out a little. While everyone else was celebrating, my father was giving me training in firearms. "Do you know how to tell who the enemy is in wartime, Cassie?" His eyes darted around the shack. Why couldn't he look at me? "The guy who's shooting at you. That's how you tell. Don't forget that." He nodded toward the gun. "Don't walk around with it. Keep it close, but keep it hidden. Not in here, and not in the barracks, okay?" Shoulder pat. Shoulder pat not quite enough. Big hug. "From now on, never let Sam out of your sight. Understand, Cassie? Never. Now go find him. I've got to see Hutchfield. And Cassie, if someone tries to take that rifle from you, you tell them to bring it up with me. And if they still try to take it, shoot them." He smiled. Not with his eyes, though. His eyes were as hard and blank and cold as a shark's. He was lucky, my dad. All of us were. Luck had carried us through the first three waves. But even the best gambler will tell you that luck only lasts so long. I think my dad had a feeling that day. Not that our luck had run out. No one could know that. But I think he knew in the end it wouldn't be the lucky ones left standing. It would be the hardcore. The ones who tell Lady Luck to go screw herself. The ones with hearts of stone. The ones who could let 100 die so one might live. The ones who see the wisdom in torching a village in order to save it. The world was foobar now. And if you're not okay with that, you're just a corpse waiting to happen. I took the M16 and hid it behind a tree bordering the path to the ash pit.
Chapter 17. The last remnant of the world I knew ripped apart on a sunny, warm Sunday afternoon. Heralded by the growl of diesel engines, the rumble and squeak of axles, the whine of air brakes. Our sentries spotted the convoy long before it reached the compound. Saw the bright sunlight glinting off windows and the plumes of dust trailing the huge tires like contrails. We didn't rush out to greet them with flowers and kisses. We stayed back while Hutchfield, Dad, and our four best shooters went out to meet them. Everyone was feeling a little spooked, and a lot less enthusiastic than we'd been just a few hours before. Everything we'd expected to happen since the arrival didn't. Everything we hadn't did. It took 2 whole weeks into the third wave for us to realize that the deadly flu was part of their plan. Still, you tend to believe what you always believed, think what you always thought, expect what you always expected. So it was never, will we be rescued? It was, when will we be rescued? And when we saw exactly what we wanted to see, what we expected to see, the big flatbed loaded with soldiers, the Humvees bristling with machine gun turrets and surface-to-air launchers, we still held back. Then the school buses pulled into view, 3 of them, bumper to bumper, packed with kids. Nobody expected that. Like I said, it was so weirdly normal, so shockingly surreal. Some of us actually laughed. A yellow freaking school bus! Where the hell is this school? After a few tense minutes, where all we could hear was the throaty snarl of engines and the faint laughter and calls of the children on the buses, Dad left Hutchfield talking to the commander and came over to me and Sammy. A knot of people gathered around us to listen in.
"They're from Wright-Patterson," Dad said. He sounded out of breath. "And apparently a lot more of our military has survived than we thought."
"Why are they wearing gas masks?" I asked.
"It's precautionary," he answered. "They've been in lockdown since the plague hit. We've all been exposed. We could be carriers."
He looked down at Sammy, who was pressed up against me, his arms wrapped around my leg.
"They've come for the children," Dad said.
"Why?" I asked.
"What about us?" Mother Teresa demanded. "Aren't they going to take us too?"
"He says they're coming back for us. Right now there's only room for the children."
Looking at Sammy.
"They're not splitting us up," I said to Dad.
"Of course not." He turned away and abruptly marched into the barracks, came out again carrying my backpack and Sammy's bear.
"You're going with him."
He didn't get it.
"I'm not going without you," I said. What was it about guys like my father? Somebody in charge shows up and they check their brains at the door.
"You heard what he said?"
Mother Teresa cried shrilly, shaking her beads.
"Just the children. If anyone else goes, it should be me. Women, that's how it's done. Women and children first. Women and children."
Dad ignored her. There went the hand on my shoulder. I shrugged his hand away.
"Cassie, they have to get the most vulnerable to safety first. I'll be just a few hours behind you."
"No," I shouted. "We all stay or we all go, Dad. Tell them we'll be fine here until they get back. I can take care of him. I've been taking care of him."
"And you will take care of him, Cassie, because you're going too."
"Not without you. I won't leave you here, Dad."
He smiled like I had said something kitty cute.
"I can take care of myself."
I couldn't put it into words, this feeling like a hot coal in my gut, that splitting up what was left of our family would be the end of our family. That if I left him behind, I would never see him again. Maybe it wasn't rational, but the world I lived in wasn't rational anymore. Dad pried Sammy from my leg, slung him onto his hip, grabbed my elbow with his free hand and marched us toward the buses. You couldn't see the soldiers' faces through the buggy-looking gas masks, but you could read the names stitched onto their green camouflage. Green, Walters, Parker.
Good, solid, all-American names. And the American flags on their sleeves. And the way they held themselves. Erect but loose. Alert but relaxed. Coiled springs. The way you expect soldiers to look. We reached the last bus in the line. The children inside shouted and waved at us. It was all one big adventure. The burly soldier at the door raised his hand. His name patch said Branch.
"Children only," he said, his voice muffled by the mask.
"I understand, Corporal," Dad said.
"Cassie, why are you crying?" Sammy said.
His little hand reached for my face. Daddy lowered him to the ground, knelt to bring his face close to Sammy's.
"You're going to go on a trip, Sam," Dad said. "These nice army men are taking you to a place where you'll be safe."
"Aren't you coming, Daddy?"
Tugging on Dad's shirt with his tiny hands.
"Yes, yes, Daddy's coming, just not yet. Soon, though, very soon."
He pulled Sammy into his arms. Last hug.
"You be good now. You do what the nice army men tell you, okay?"
Sammy nodded, slipped his hand into mine.
"Come on, Cassie. We're going to ride a bus."
The black mask whipped around. A gloved hand went up.
"Just the boy."
I started to tell him to stuff it. I wasn't happy about leaving Dad behind, but Sammy wasn't going anywhere without me. The corporal cut me off.
"Only the boy."
"She's his sister," Dad tried. He was being reasonable. "And she's a child, too. She's only 16.
"She'll have to stay here," the corporal said.
"Then he's not getting on,"
I said, wrapping both arms around Sammy's chest. He'd have to pull my damn arms off to take my little brother. There was this awful moment when the corporal didn't say anything. I had the urge to rip the mask off his head and spit in his face. The sun glinted off the visor, a hateful ball of light.
"You want him to stay?"
"I want him to stay with me," I corrected him. "On the bus, off the bus, whatever, with me."
"No, Cassie," Dad said.
Sammy started to cry. He got it. It was Daddy and the soldier against me and him, and there was no winning that battle. He got it before I did.
"He can stay," the soldier said, "but we can't guarantee his safety."
"Oh, really?" I shouted into his bug face. "You think? Whose safety can you guarantee?"
"Cassie,"
Dad started.
"You can't guarantee shit," I yelled.
The corporal ignored me.
"It's your call, sir," he said to Dad.
"Dad," I said, "you heard him. He can stay with us."
Dad chewed on his bottom lip. He lifted his head and scratched under his chin, and his eyes regarded the empty sky. He was thinking about the drones, about what he knew and what he didn't know. He was remembering what he'd learned. He was weighing odds and calculating probabilities and ignoring the little voice piping up from the deepest part of him. Don't let him go. So, of course, he did the most reasonable thing. He was a responsible adult, and that's what responsible adults do. The reasonable thing.
"You're right, Cassie," he said finally. "They can't guarantee our safety. No one can. But some places are safer than others."
He grabbed Sammy's hand.
"Come on, sport."
"No!" Sammy screamed, tears streaming down bright red cheeks. "Not without Cassie!"
"Cassie's going," Dad said. "We're both going. We'll be right behind you."
"I'll protect him. I'll watch him. I won't let anything happen to him," I pleaded. "They're coming back for the rest of us, right? We'll just wait for them to come back."
I pulled on his shirt and put on my best pleading face. The one that usually got me what I wanted.
"Please, Daddy, don't do this. It isn't right. We have to stay together. We have to."
It wasn't going to work. He had that hard look in his eyes again. Cold, clamped down. Remorseless.
"Cassie," he said, "tell your brother it's okay."
And I did. After I told myself it was okay. I told myself to trust Dad, trust the people in charge,
Trust the others not to incinerate the school buses full of children. Trust that trust itself hadn't gone the way of computers and microwavable popcorn and the Hollywood movie where the slime balls from Planet Zircon are defeated in the final 10 minutes. I knelt on the dusty ground in front of my little brother.
"You need to go, Sams," I said. His fat lower lip bobbed up and down, clutching the bear to his chest.
"But, Cassie, who's going to hold you when you're scared?"
He was being totally serious. He looked so much like Dad with that concerned little frown that I almost laughed.
"I'm not scared anymore, and you shouldn't be scared either. The soldiers are here now, and they're going to make us safe."
I looked up at Corporal Branch.
"Isn't that right?"
"That's right."
"He looks like Darth Vader," Sammy whispered. "Sounds like him, too."
"Right, and remember what happens? He turns into a good guy at the end. Only after he blows up a whole planet and kills a lot of people."
I couldn't help it. I laughed.
God, he was smart.
Sometimes I thought he was smarter than me and Dad combined.
"You're going to come later, Cassie?"
"You bet I am."
"Promise?"
I promised. Whatever happened. No matter what. That was all he needed to hear. He pushed the teddy bear into my chest.
"Sam?
For when you're scared.
But don't leave him."
He held up a tiny finger to emphasize his point.
"Don't forget."
He stuck out his hand to the corporal.
"Lead on, Vader!"
Gloved hand engulfed pudgy hand. The first step was almost too high for his little legs. The kids inside squealed and clapped when he turned the corner and hit the center aisle. Sammy was the last to board. The door closed. Dad tried to put his arm around me. I stepped away. The engine revved. The air brakes hissed. And there was his face against the smudged glass and his smile as he rocketed across a galaxy far, far away in his yellow X-wing starfighter, jumping to warp speed until the dusty yellow spaceship was swallowed by dust. Chapter 18.
"This way, sir,"
the corporal said politely, and we followed him back to the compound. Two Humvees had left to escort the buses back to Wright-Patterson. The remaining Humvees sat facing the barracks and the storage shed, the barrels of their mounted machine guns pointing at the ground, like the dipped heads of some metallic creatures dozing. The compound was empty. Everybody, including the soldiers, had gone inside the barracks. Everybody except one. As we walked up, Hutchfield came out of the storage shed. I didn't know what was beaming brighter, his shaved head or his smile.
"Outstanding, Sullivan," he boomed at Dad. "And you wanted to bug out after that first drone."
"Looks like I was wrong," Dad said with a tight smile.
"Briefing by Colonel Vosch in 5 minutes. But first I need your ordnance."
"My what?"
"Your weapon. Colonel's orders."
Dad glanced at the soldier standing beside us. The blank, black eyes of the mask stared back at him.
"Why?"
Dad asked.
"You need an explanation?"
Hutchfield's smile stayed put, but his eyes narrowed.
"I would like one, yes." "It's SOP, Sullivan, standard operating procedure. You can't have a bunch of untrained, inexperienced civilians packing heat in wartime."
Talking down to him like he was a moron. He held out his hand. Dad pulled the rifle slowly from his shoulder. Hutchfield snatched the rifle from Dad and disappeared into the storehouse. Dad turned to the corporal.
"Has anyone made contact with the..."
He searched for the right word.
"The others?"
One word spoken in a raspy monotone.
"No."
Hutchfield came out and smartly saluted the corporal. He was neck deep in his element now, back with his brothers in arms. He was bursting all over with excitement, like any second he would pee himself.
"All weapons accounted for and secured, Corporal."
All except two, I thought. I looked at Dad. He didn't move a muscle, except the ones around his eyes. Flick to the right, flick to the left.
No. There was only one reason I could think of that he'd do that. And when I think about it, if I think too much about it, I start to hate my father. Hate him for distrusting his own instincts. Hate him for ignoring the little voice that must have been whispering, "This is wrong. Something about this is wrong." I hate him right now. If he were here right now, I'd punch him in the face for being such an ignorant dweeb.
The corporal motioned toward the barracks. It was time for Colonel Vosh's briefing. Time for the world to end.
Chapter 19. I picked out Vosh right away. Standing just inside the door, very tall, the only guy in fatigues not cradling a rifle against his chest. He nodded to Hutchfield when we stepped inside the old hospital/charnel house. Then Corporal Branch gave a salute and squeezed into the line of soldiers that ringed the walls. That's how it was. Soldiers standing along three of the four walls, refugees in the middle. Dad's hand sought out mine. Sammy's teddy in one hand, the other hanging onto his. "How about it, Dad? Did that little voice get louder when you saw the men with guns against the walls? Is that why you grabbed my hand?"
"All right, now can we get some answers?"
someone shouted when we stepped inside. Everybody started to talk at once, everyone except the soldiers, shouting out questions.
"Have they landed? What do they look like? What are they? What are those gray ships we keep seeing in the sky? When do the rest of us get to leave? How many survivors have you found?"
Vosh held up his hand for quiet. It only half worked. Hutchfield gave him a smart salute.
"All present and accounted for, sir."
I did a quick head count. "No," I said. I raised my voice to be heard over the din.
"No!"
I looked at Dad. "Crisco's not here." Hutchfield frowned.
"Who's Crisco?"
"He's this kid.
"Kid? Then he left on the buses with the others."
The others. It's kind of funny when I think about it now. Funny in a sickening way.
"We need everyone in this building," Vosh
said from behind his mask. His voice was very deep, a subterranean rumble.
"He probably had a freak out," I said. "He's kind of a wuss."
"Where would he go?"
Vosh asked. I shook my head. I had no clue. Then I did, more than a clue. I knew where Crisco had gone.
"The ash pit."
"Where is the ash pit?"
"Cassie," Dad spoke up. He was squeezing my hand hard. "Why don't you go get Crisco for us so the Colonel can start our briefing?"
"Me?"
I didn't get it. I think Dad's little voice was screaming by this point, but I couldn't hear it, and he couldn't say it. All he could do was try to telegraph it with his eyes. Maybe it was this. "Do you know how to tell who the enemy is, Cassie?" I don't know why he didn't volunteer to go with me. Maybe he thought they wouldn't suspect a kid of anything, and one of us would make it, or at least have a chance to make it. Maybe.
"All right,"
Vosh said. He flicked his finger at Corporal Branch. "Go with her."
"She'll be okay alone," Dad said. "She knows these woods like the back of her hand. 5 minutes, right, Cassie?"
He looked at Vosh and smiled.
"5 minutes." "Don't be a dumbass, Sullivan," Hutchfield said. "She can't go out there without an escort."
"Sure," Dad said.
"Right. You're right, of course."
He leaned over and gave me a hug. Not too tight, not too long. A quick hug. Squeeze, release. Anything more would seem like a goodbye. "Goodbye, Cassie."
Branch turned to his commander and said, "First priority, sir?"
And Vosh nodded,
"First priority."
We stepped into the bright sunshine, the man in the gas mask and the girl with the teddy bear. Straight ahead, a couple of soldiers were leaning against a Humvee. I hadn't seen them when we passed the Humvees before. They straightened at the sight of us. Corporal Branch gave them a thumbs up and then held up his index finger. First priority.
"How far is it?"
he asked me. "Not far," I answered.
My voice sounded very small to me. Maybe it was Sammy's teddy, tugging me back to childhood. He followed me down the trail that snaked into the dense woods behind the compound, rifle held in front of him, barrel down. The dry ground crunched in protest under his brown boots. The day was warm, but it was cooler under the trees, their leaves a rich late summer green. We passed the tree where I'd stashed the M16. I didn't look back at it. I kept walking toward the clearing. And there he was, the little shit, up to his ankles in bones and dust, clawing through the broken remains for that last useless, priceless trinket. One more for the road, so whenever he got to where the road ended, he'd be the man. His head came around when we stepped inside the ring of trees, glistening with sweat and the crap he slopped in his hair. Streaks of black soot stained his cheeks. He looked like some sorry-ass excuse of a football player. When he saw us, his hand whipped behind his back. Something silver flashed in the sun.
"Hey, Cassie? Hey, there you are! I came back here looking for you because you weren't in the barracks, and then I saw... There was this..."
"Is he the one?" the soldier asked me. He slung the rifle over his shoulder and took a step toward the pit. It was me, the soldier in the middle, and Crisco in the pit of ash and bone.
"Yeah," I said. "That's Crisco." "That's not my name," he squeaked. "My real name is..."
I'll never know Crisco's real name. I didn't see the gun, or hear the report of the soldier's sidearm. I didn't see the soldier draw it from his holster. But I wasn't looking at the soldier. I was looking at Crisco. His head snapped back like someone had yanked on his greasy locks, and he sort of folded up as he went down, clutching the treasures of the dead in his hand.
Chapter 20. My turn. The girl wearing the backpack and carrying the ridiculous teddy bear standing just a couple of yards behind him. The soldier pivoted, arm extended. My memory's a little fuzzy about this next part. I don't remember dropping the bear or yanking the gun from my back pocket. I don't even remember pulling the trigger. The next clear memory I have is of the black visor shattering, and the soldier falling to his knees in front of me, and seeing his eyes, his three eyes. Well, of course, I realized later he didn't really have three eyes. The one in the middle was the blackened entry wound of the bullet. It must have shocked him to turn around and see a gun pointed at his face. It made him hesitate. How long? A second? Less than a second? But in that millisecond, eternity coiled on itself like a giant anaconda. If you've ever been through a traumatic accident, you know what I'm talking about. How long does a car crash last? 10 seconds? 5? It doesn't feel that short if you're in it. It feels like a lifetime. He pitched over face first into the dirt. There was no question I'd wasted him. My bullet had blasted a pie plate-sized hole in the back of his head. But I didn't lower the gun. I kept it pointed at his half head as I backed toward the trail. Then I turned and ran like hell. In the wrong direction. Toward the compound. Not smart. But I wasn't thinking at that point. I'm only 16, and this was the first person I'd shot point blank in the face. I was having trouble dealing. I just wanted to get back to Dad. Dad would fix this. Because that's what dads do, they fix things. My mind didn't register the sounds at first. The woods echoed with the staccato bursts of automatic weapons and people screaming, but it wasn't computing. Like Crisco's head snapping back and the way he flopped into the gray dust like every bone in his body had suddenly turned to jello, the way his killer had swung around in a perfectly executed pirouette with the barrel of the gun flashing in the sunlight. The world was ripping apart, and pieces of the wreckage were raining all around me. It was the beginning of the fourth wave. I skittered to a stop before reaching the compound. The hot smell of gunpowder. Wisps of smoke curling out of the barrack windows. There was a person crawling toward the storage shed. It was my father. His back was arched. His face was covered in dirt and blood. The ground behind my father was pockmarked with my father's blood. He looked over as I came out of the trees.
No, Cassie, he mouthed.
Then his arms gave out. He toppled over, lay still. A soldier emerged from the barracks. He strolled over to my father. Easy, cat-like grace, shoulders relaxed, arms loose at his sides. I backed into the trees. I raised the gun. But I was over 100 feet away. If I missed, it was Vosh. He seemed even taller, standing over the crumpled form of my father. Dad wasn't moving. I think he was playing dead. It didn't matter. Vosh shot him anyway. I don't remember making any noise when he pulled the trigger. But I must have done something to set off Vosh's spidey sense. The black mask whipped around, sunlight flashing off the visor. He held up his index finger toward two soldiers coming out of the barracks, then jabbed his thumb in my direction. First priority. Chapter 21. They took off toward me like a couple of cheetahs. That's how fast they seemed to move. I'd never seen anyone run that fast in my life. The only thing that comes close is a scared, shitless girl who's just seen her father murdered in the dirt. Leaf, branch, vine, bramble, the rush of air in my ears, the rapid-fire scuff, scuff, scuff of my shoes on the trail. Shards of blue sky through the canopy, blades of sunlight impaling the shattered earth. The ripped-apart world careened. I slowed as I neared the spot where I'd hidden my father's last present to me. Mistake. The high-caliber round smacked into the tree trunk 2 inches from my ear. The impact sent fragments of pulverized wood into my face. Tiny, hair-thin slivers embedded themselves in my cheek. Do you know how to tell who the enemy is, Cassie? I couldn't outrun them. I couldn't outgun them. Maybe I could outsmart them. Chapter 22. They entered the clearing, and the first thing they saw was the body of Corporal Branch, or whatever it was that called itself Corporal Branch.
There's one over there, I heard one say.
The crunch of heavy boots in a bowl full of brittle bones.
Dead.
The cackle of a static frequency, then...
Colonel, we've got Branch and one unidentified civilian. That's a negative, sir. Branch is KIA. Repeat, Branch is KIA.
Now he spoke to his buddy, the one standing by Crisco.
Vosh wants us back ASAP.
Crunch, crunch, said the bones as he heaved himself out of the pit.
She ditched this.
My backpack. I tried to throw it into the woods, as far away from the pit as I could. But it hit a tree and landed just inside the far edge of the clearing.
Strange, the voice said. It's okay, his buddy said. The eye will take care of her.
The eye? Their voices faded. The sound of the woods at peace returned. A whisper of wind. The warble of birds. Somewhere in the brush, a squirrel fussed. Still, I didn't move. Each time the urge to run started to rise up in me, I squashed it down. No hurry now, Cassie. They've done what they've come to do. You have to stay here till dark. Don't move. So I didn't. I lay still inside the bed of dust and bones, covered by the ashes of their victims, the others' bitter harvest. And I tried not to think about it, what I was covered in. Then I thought, these bones were people, and these people saved my life. And then I didn't feel so creeped. They were just people. They didn't ask to be there any more than I did. But they were there, and I was there. So I lay still. It's weird, but it was almost like I felt their arms, warm and soft, enfolding me. I don't know how long I lay there, with the arms of dead people holding me. It felt like hours. When I finally stood up, the sunlight had aged to a golden sheen, and the air had turned a little cooler. I was covered head to toe in gray ash. I must have looked like a Mayan warrior. The eye will take care of her.
Was he talking about the drones?
an eye-in-the-sky thing? And if he was talking about the drones, then this wasn't some rogue unit scouring the countryside to waste possible carriers of the third wave so the unexposed wouldn't be infected. That would definitely be bad. But the alternative would be much, much worse. I trotted over to my backpack. The deep woods called to me. The more distance I put between myself and them, the better it was going to be. Then I remembered my father's gift. Far up the path, practically within spitting distance of the compound. Crap, why hadn't I stashed it in the ash pit? It sure might prove more useful than a handgun. I didn't hear anything. Even the birds had gone mum. Just wind. Its fingers trailed through the mounds of ash, flicking it into the air, where it danced fitfully in the golden light. They were gone. It was safe. But I hadn't heard them leave. Wouldn't I have heard the roar of the flatbed motor, the growl of the Humvees as they left? Then I remembered Branch stepping toward Crisco. Is he the one? Swinging the rifle behind his shoulder? The rifle. I crept over to the body. My footfalls sounded like thunder, my own breath like mini explosions. He had fallen face down at my feet. Now he was face up, though that face was still mostly hidden by the gas mask. His sidearm and rifle were gone. They must have taken them. For a second, I didn't move. And moving was a very good idea at that juncture of the battle. This wasn't part of the third wave. This was something completely different. It was the beginning of the fourth, definitely. And maybe the fourth wave was a sick version of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Maybe Branch wasn't human and that's why he was wearing a mask. I knelt beside the dead soldier, grasped the top of the mask firmly and pulled until I could see his eyes. Very human-looking brown eyes, staring sightlessly into my face. I kept pulling. Stopped. I wanted to see, and I didn't want to see. I wanted to know, but I didn't want to know. Just go. It doesn't matter, Cassie. Does it matter? No, it doesn't matter. Sometimes you say things to your fear. Things like, it doesn't matter. The words acting like pats on the head of a hyper dog. I stood up. No, it really didn't matter if the soldier had a mouth like a lobster or looked like Justin Bieber's twin brother. I grabbed Sammy's teddy from the dirt and headed for the far side of the clearing. Something stopped me, though. I didn't head off into the woods. I didn't rush off to embrace the one thing with the best chance to save me, distance. It might have been the teddy bear that did it. When I picked it up, I saw my brother's face pressed against the back window of the bus. Heard his little voice inside my head.
For when you're scared. But don't leave him. Don't forget.
I almost did forget. If I hadn't walked over to check Branch for weapons, I would have. Branch had fallen practically on top of poor Teddy.
Don't leave him.
I didn't actually see any bodies back there. Just Dad's. What if someone had survived those 3 minutes of eternity in the barracks? They could have been wounded, still alive, left for dead. Unless I didn't leave. If there was someone still alive back there and the foe soldiers had gone, then I would be the one leaving them for dead. Ah, crap. You know how sometimes you tell yourself that you have a choice, but really you don't have a choice? Just because there are alternatives doesn't mean they apply to you. I turned around and headed back. Stepping around the body of Branch as I went, and dove into the dusky tunnel of the trail. Chapter 23. I didn't forget the assault rifle the third time around. I shoved the Luger into my belt, but I couldn't very well expect to fire an assault rifle with a teddy bear in one hand, so I had to leave him on the trail.
It's okay, I won't forget you, I whispered to Sammy's bear.
I stepped off the path and wove quietly through the trees. When I got close to the compound, I dropped and crawled the rest of the way to the edge.
Well, that's why you didn't hear them leave.
Vosh was talking to a couple of soldiers at the doorway to the storehouse. Another group was messing around by one of the Humvees. I counted 7 in all, which left 5 more I couldn't see. Were they off in the woods somewhere looking for me? Dad's body was gone. Maybe the others had pulled disposal duty. There were 42 of us, not counting the kids who had left on the buses. That's a lot of disposing. Turns out I was right. It was a disposal operation. It's just that silencers don't dispose of bodies the way we do. Vosh had taken off his mask. So had the 2 guys who were with him. They didn't have lobster mouths or tentacles growing out of their chins. They looked like perfectly ordinary human beings, at least from a distance. They didn't need the masks anymore. Why not? The masks must have been part of the act. We would expect them to protect themselves from infection. 2 of the soldiers came over from the Humvee carrying what looked like a bowl or globe, the same dull gray metallic color as the drones. Vosh pointed at a spot midway between the storehouse and the barracks. The same spot, it looked like, where my father had fallen. Then everybody left, except one female soldier who was kneeling now beside the gray globe. The Humvees roared to life. Another engine joined the duet. The flatbed troop carrier parked at the head of the compound out of sight. I'd forgotten about that. The rest of the soldiers must have already loaded up and were waiting. Waiting for what? The remaining soldier stood up and trotted back to the Humvee. I watched him climb aboard. Watched the Humvee spin out in a boiling cloud of dust. Watched the dust swirl and settle. The stillness of summer at dusk settled with it. The silence pounded in my ears. And then the gray globe began to glow. That was a good thing, a bad thing, or a thing that was neither good nor bad. But whatever it was, good, bad, or neither, depended on your point of view. They had put the globe there, so to them it was a good thing. The glow was getting brighter. A sickly yellowish green, pulsing slightly, like a what? A beacon? I peered into the darkening sky. The first stars had begun to come out. I didn't see any drones. If it was a good thing from their point of view, that meant it was probably a bad thing from mine. Well, not probably. Leaning more toward definitely. The interval between pulses shortened every few seconds. The pulse became a flash. The flash became a blink. Pulse, pulse, pulse. Flash, flash, flash. Blink, blink, blink. In the gloom, the globe reminded me of an eye, a pale greenish-yellow eyeball winking at me. The eye will take care of her. My memory has preserved what happened next as a series of snapshots, like freeze-frame stills from an art house movie, with those jerky, handheld camera angles. Shot 1. On my butt, doing a crab crawl away from the compound. Shot 2. On my feet, running, the foliage a blur of green and brown and mossy gray. Shot 3. Sammy's bear. The chewed-up little arm gum and gnawed since he was a baby slipping from my fingers. Shot 4. Me on my second attempt to pick up that damned bear. Shot 5. The ash pit in the foreground. I'm halfway between Crisco's body and branches, clutching Sammy's bear to my chest. Shot 6 through 10. More woods, more me running. If you look closely, you can see the ravine in the left-hand corner of the 10th frame. Shot 11. The final frame. I'm suspended in mid-air above the shadow-filled ravine, taken right after I launched myself off the edge. The green wave roared over my curled-up body at the bottom, carrying along tons of debris, a rocketing mass of trees, dirt, the bodies of birds and squirrels and woodchucks and insects, the contents of the ash pit, shards of the pulverized barracks and storehouse, plywood, concrete, nails, tin, and the first couple of inches of soil in 100-yard radius of the blast. I felt the shockwave before I hit the muddy bottom of the ravine. An intense, bone-rattling pressure over every inch of my body.
My eardrums popped, and I remember Crisco saying, "You know what happens when you're blasted with 200 decibels?" No, Crisco, I don't, but I've got an idea.